Intelligent Talk, 1170 KCBQ. The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you think Christians are freaks who need to get a life and quit talking about Jesus so much. Indeed, that is a common term that's been used for years, Jesus freaks. In fact, before I became a Christian, I used to call Jesus freaks. But hey, buddy, if you're calling me that now, well, that's different. I resent your insinuation that I'm a Jesus freak who can only talk about Jesus. And I'll tell you why. Because I'm also a movie freak who likes to talk about movies. I showed you. And today, I'd like to welcome back my good friend who wrote the book on being a movie freak. He's light years ahead of me on this. He's the freakiest of all, a movie freak on steroids, film critic Mark Boobian. And since Mark also likes to find Christian themes in films, he helps us to do the impossible. We can be Jesus freaks and movie freaks at the same time. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Bob. My favorite thing to do is be both at the same time, exactly. And so today we're going to talk about my favorite genre of films.
Don't tell me.
Science fiction.
You told me, Bob.
It's almost like you know me.
Well, I love science fiction too.
Talk about
being two things at the same time. My two favorite kinds of films are science fictions and movie musicals, which you hate.
I hate.
But yeah, people go to my shelf and they see the macho sci-fi section,
right,
and then they see the wussy, you know, musicals, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have that part on my show, so I'm cool. So the big science fiction opening this year, I think even, is Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. It's his follow-up from, he did the Batman movies, the recent Batman movies, which were all stellar hits.
And as I recall, you had never liked Batman until The Dark Knight came out. Batman Begins, I guess.
I was warmed up, yeah, a little bit.
The Dark Knight was a classic movie. I know you spent almost a whole show on it, maybe a whole show on it.
Right. I could probably talk about that movie forever. Yeah. There's so much there. That's an awesome work of art. And unlike the previous version of Batman, which we don't talk about.
At least like Jack Nicholson saying, where does he get those wonderful toys?
Yeah, see, I like hearing you say it better than him. That's how much I didn't like that movie. But Interstellar's, what's so awesome about Interstellar is that it's really entrenched in an era of science fiction that was my favorite as a science fiction reader, which is known as the golden age of science fiction, which is it gave us Isaac Asimov, Robert Heinlein, who I don't like very much, but is very famous.
I didn't notice when I watched it. I did watch it. I thought it was an excellent movie, too. Was the screenplay writer Nolan, or was it somebody who's a classic?
It was Nolan, but not the Nolan you're thinking of.
Oh,
His brother wrote the movie.
And has he written science fiction before, his brother?
Actually, the story behind this movie is kind of interesting. It was originally going to be a Spielberg movie, and this was written years ago.
I'm 50-50 with Spielberg.
Yeah, I read some of the stuff that Spielberg had planned with it, and it would not have
He's
been.
He's great with special effects, but when it comes to character development, plot, dialogue, Spielberg doesn't excel well.
Right, and I think that this movie really needed everything to work so well, and one big advantage they had is they actually had a physicist who got an executive producer credit on the film because he was so deeply involved. And there's a scene in the film with equations written across the board where they're trying to solve the problem of of time and gravity. And those are real equations that this particular physicist, his name is Kip Thorne, he actually wrote those on the board before they filmed that scene. And those are real equations he's working on himself. And he's done a lot of work with black holes, which is a key plot element to the film, as well as wormholes and that kind of stuff. So his involvement was really critical because it made the movie so much more real, in the sense of it just gave you the sense of really being there in space, and kind of not so much that space is scary, but it's dangerous and threatening and exciting and interesting and beautiful as well. But the physics of it was actually something that I found interesting.
Like, let's educate our audience a little bit for those that aren't as much into science, and this will refresh me. Tell me if I'm wrong, because science isn't my thing. A black hole was once a star, right?
Yes, that's correct. A really huge, huge star that collapsed upon itself. When stars die, they collapse and then they explode.
And in theory, if you went through a black hole, it would be like folding a piece of paper and going through like going through folded space. Now, a wormhole does something similar, but a wormhole is created how? No. The difference between a wormhole and a black hole, basically.
Well, okay. See, now you're getting into really deep.
I just remember the Next Generation, the dumb Ferengi that went through the wormhole and then they couldn't get out the other side.
Right. That's. Right. Yeah. Well,
the Ferengi interestingly, did not know their wormholes very well.
Yeah. Well, that's where I learned about wormholes, is actually in Deep Space Nine. But what's interesting about wormholes is what they claim in the film is that they can only be man-made or they can only be constructed.
See, now I remember them saying that
in the movie, but
I don't remember ever hearing that before, a wormhole could only be man-made.
Yeah, and I'm not sure. And what you're talking about in terms of black holes, nobody knows what happens in a black hole.
Yeah, but in theory. I mean, in science fiction, that's what they do a lot.
That's the primary depiction of black holes. Like, even the movie The Black Hole had them go into the black hole at the end and pass through it into another universe.
And then they went into heaven inside.
So. Is that really what it was?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
How
did you miss the Christian symbolism in that one?
Yeah, I don't know, because I was only 12.
Okay, you weren't looking for Christian symbolism.
I was looking for a good movie, and I didn't find it there.
Even if it's just within the rules of science fiction, don't wormholes and black holes within science fiction accomplish the same thing? You're going from one part of space to another part?
Yes and no. I mean, wormholes, yes. Black holes, who knows? That's really got to be the answer. And one thing I learned is that there's multiple types of black holes. They refer to this one as a gentle black hole in the movie. And there are certain physics involved with that, which gave the movie its ability to do some of the things they did. When passing into the black hole, there were certain physical theories that they've got about it that, you know, made certain things possible.
Wow, you'd think with a name like black hole, you'd wonder how many can there be. We're not going to have a red black hole. We're not going to have a blue black hole.
Okay, the irony of that statement, Bob, is that black holes do show red and blue because it's called blue shift and red shift when things move very quickly towards you or away from you. And one of the special effects they actually had for the film that they couldn't put in it was that it's spinning so fast that on one side everything looks blue and on the other side everything looks red. But when they visualized it, it looked so confusing that they had to actually remove it. So ironically enough, yes, black holes
remember being a little kid with those super duper boxes of Crayola crayons, the ones with the many, many colors. And if you put them all together with one crayon on top of another, it all came out black when you combined them.
But it wasn't a black hole, unfortunately.
No, but
you could only make one that easily.
That was the limitation of my science experience. I was not the kid with the chemistry set.
Right. Well, neither was I. I was busy reading about science fiction rather than doing science so much.
Me too. I've always loved science fiction, and yet when I've been would take actual science classes, I'd be bored to death. Although I think sometimes that was the teacher, you know.
Today, yeah, it could have been.
We're going to do an experiment. I mean,
you don't actually get to do too many hardcore calculus equations when you're reading a science fiction book. You get to skip that part to all the fun stuff that happens. So but one of the things that I really loved about this movie as a huge science fiction fan was that I saw a variety of references to other works. Now, The most obvious one, and it's been talked about. I think it was talked about
2001,
even before the movie came out. Right.
2001
Space
even
Odyssey.
They even had not the actual theme, but the theme would always come to a crescendo at the end of 2000. That and I heard that, and I was almost sure they were doing that deliberately.
Yeah, and I think so too. And so they had both audio and visual references to other films. Now,
but unlike 2001, well developed characters, and this movie had some dialogue in it. Unlike 2001,
right?
I loved 2001, by the way.
Right, but, they are actually very different movies.
But you cared about the characters in this movie, and a little more than you did in 2001.
Right, because you really
you got to know them better.
Yeah, and 2001 had a break right in the middle where you switch from one group of characters to another, and that's
very difficult.
It was
like a four-act with like four little films in one, each one being very different. Yeah.
Right, so that does make it much harder to relate to the characters. Now, this movie is not like that. Matthew McConaughey, what's great about him is that he's an extremely relatable, kind of normal guy as a person and as an actor. And he surfs. I mean, come on, how much better can you get than that?
I just have to tell you, he's been in so many movies, and you know how I've talked about how Nicolas Cage and people like that,
right.
They're just in too many movies. And so, and another person like that is Michael Caine. So I remember watching this movie, and I'm going, oh, Matthew McConaughey, he's just in too many movies. He's like Michael Caine. And lo and behold, Michael Caine's also in the movie.
Well, of course Michael Caine is, because he's been in almost every single Christopher Nolan movie
I think
ever
one
made.
Of the three, movies, period. It's like, and for every good one, he does a clunk. He used to make 10 or 12 pictures a year, I heard. So.
Well, fortunately for Michael Caine, everything he's done with Christopher Nolan has been great, amazing, awesome. And he's even the moral center of the Batman universe, in a sense, when he plays the character Alfred.
Right.
Where he's challenging Batman in the things that he's doing.
And he was a very interesting character.
Yeah, and so he
almost makes you forget the Jaws 3 or Jaws 4. Which
Jaws 4,
in.
Right. Jaws the 4? Revenge. Yeah, I didn't have to see it, so
And it's always a shark related to the other shark, too. They can't even have him get bitten by another. The audience is so stupid that if it isn't the same family of sharks.
Right.
Well, okay, I'm here with film critic Mark Boubian, and we are critiquing, and we're giving it a very good critique. The movie Interstellar by Christopher Nolan. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. WisdomWorksChristianPreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Welcome back to is KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. Quick programming note. Next week, co-host Kevin Conover and I will be interviewing a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or Mormon for short, comparing his beliefs with ours. You don't want to miss that. But today, my co-host is film critic Mark Boobie. And Mark, welcome back to our program.
Thanks again, Bob. So we're talking about Interstellar, and we were talking about 2001 A Space Odyssey. Let me point out a few of the things that I saw visually that refer to 2001, and I don't think he was trying to make a copy of 2001 or anything like
I think
that.
But maybe a homage to it, not a
ripoff.
I don't
even think that, actually. No? I think it was just its own movie, but then there were similarities, so it seemed like he decided to pay homage, yes, but just in certain visual aspects.
Well, they both had spaceships in outer space. So
right.
If 2001 came out first, so he has to credit them
yes,
for that.
Yes, right. Okay, there you go. But I think it goes a little further than that. So there's this surreal scene near the end of the movie, which obviously, well, if you haven't seen 2001, you've probably heard that there's a very long, surreal sequence in that movie, kind of similar thing happens, but it's not nearly as long and drawn out.
And if they hadn't made it in the 60s, they never would have gotten away with it, because
right.
It was like a psychedelic mind trip.
Totally, and it goes on forever.
You could go on a mind trip without doing acid.
Right,
you know?
There you go. Right. Well, fortunately, this movie knew to cut that part short. And so,
but that part was beautiful. The effects were very beautiful in this movie.
Yes.
During that part.
And again, back to the physicist, a lot of the stuff we see in the movie were actually based on his real equations. So they used his mathematics to generate some of the things we saw, like the entrance to the wormhole, the black hole itself. Those are actually as close to real as we can get right now with visualizing them.
And 2001, before the surrealistic scene, in terms of the technology, was very realistic and plausible. And
right.
I like it when science fiction is a little closer to science.
Yes, absolutely.
It makes it better science fiction.
Right, and I agree with you. There, and this is one of those movies
Star
that
Wars
is.
Wouldn't quite be in that.
No. Category. Oh, yes, right.
With the Wookiee
right.
And...
Yeah, that Star Wars is a fun movie, but right,
Star Wars is fantasy set in outer space.
Right. So, some of the things... 2001 has this very famous ending scene where there's this referred to as the solar baby. It's the... to me, I take it as representing the next step in human
next evolution.
Evolution,
yeah. Because it started with apes evolving into men.
And right, and so here in Interstellar, we have a similar scene with Matthew McConaughey he's in a space suit with his helmet on, but it's a close-up of him floating in space, and it's very, very reminiscent of 2001. Another interesting thing is that the wormhole that we're referring to, so in the movie, the planet Earth is dying for inexplicable reasons, no explanation given, and then a wormhole appears, and this is our chance to get off the planet, go to another solar system or another galaxy, and be saved, basically. And Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway and a few other actors are their role is to go through the wormhole and find what's in the galaxy. So. So there's a lot of stuff that, again, the science here is really rock solid, and people have been very nitpicky about it, but I found it very, very believable. Now, some things that we see, like there's a scene of Saturn. Okay, so I mentioned Saturn. The thing I wanted to mention about 2001, that takes place at Jupiter. The reason it's in Jupiter in 2001 is because the technology of the era did not allow them to place the monolith in space where they wanted it to go, which was Saturn.
Yeah, and I if I'm recalling correctly, I read the novel of 2001 years ago. I think they made it Saturn.
He probably did, because that's what was the original plan, but they could not visualize Saturn. They didn't have the technology to do it, so they did Jupiter instead.
And that was the rare collaboration where the book and movie were being produced and written simultaneously.
At the same time, and in great conflict, too, which is interesting. But what's also funny is there's references to 2010 Odyssey 2. We see a scene where they come around Saturn early in the film, and there's kind of flashes of light off of the spaceship. This is known as atmospheric braking, and it's a real physical process. You can speed up by going close to a planet and slingshotting around its gravity well, And another, if you get close enough, though, you can go into the atmosphere and slow down. But it creates a lot of friction and flame. And so that's what they were representing in this movie. It happens in 2010. It happens in this movie. Very clear. To me, it was a very obvious reference to 2010. Now, given that John Lithgow is in both movies, I guess that would be considered another reference to 2010 Odyssey 2. Another thing, references to other science fiction. Here's one that you'll love, Bob, okay? Deep Space Nine is the only other show or movie or whatever that I've really seen the idea of a wormhole central to the plot. And
yeah,
it's an artificially
because
constructed...
Because instead of traveling around space, they were going to let aliens come to them through the wormhole.
Right, exactly. But it was an artificially constructed...
Constructed by the prophets.
Yes.
Of Bajor.
Exactly. See, hey, you know everything
about Two Star Trek geeks, yeah.
That's right. So... And as
we don't know exactly what a wormhole is, but we know Star Trek, doggone it.
Right. Yes, well, there's a lot of people that know Star Trek probably, too. So.
We know that Voyager sucked raw ends with two straws, and
yes.
Deep Space Nine was the good
Star
Trek
show. The absolute best Star Trek ever got. So, interestingly, they're artificially created wormhole in both shows. But as they approach the wormhole in this movie, in Interstellar... One of the characters is named Romney, and Matthew McConaughey looks back at him and says, "Rom, what are we doing now?"
I picked up on the fact that it reminded me of 2001, but I didn't catch any of these.
Yeah,
little
so
nuances.
This is a Rom is a character from Deep Space Nine, which Bob knows, of course.
Well, he was one of the Ferengi that we talked about
exactly,
earlier.
Exactly. Yes, and he started off as a bad character, became a great character in the show. One of the great things about that show was their ability to do that.
And the beautiful Dabo girl who loved him, though, you had to suspend more belief for that than any other special effects.
Chase Masterson, yes. That's that. She played the Dabo girl. I met her at Comic-Con, actually. That was actually one of my exciting moments at Comic-Con.
Yeah, you told me that. I forgot about
that. Yeah, it was really nice. She's very, very nice person. Wonderful to talk to. I even interrupted a cell phone call she was making, and she was super sweet anyway. So I can't say anything bad about her. She was just a wonderful person.
Okay, well, Mark and I don't always agree on movies, but we do agree that this was an excellent movie, Interstellar. We'll be right back to talk some more about it. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric, Incorporated. License number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Hi, this is Dana Wright here to announce that Bob Siegel has finally entered the 21st century. It had to happen sooner or later. Now, Bob's popular book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... is available in ebook format and can be downloaded to your Kindle or Nook. Whenever Bob speaks, people are eager to purchase this book afterwards. But sometimes parents inform him that their kids will not read anything that they can't put on an e-reader. Well, now that is no longer a problem. So if you want a book that can help everyone in your family offer better answers to good, skeptical questions that people ask about Christianity, go to Amazon.com. or BarnesandNoble.com for I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But by Bob Siegel, now available for download as an ebook.
Oh,
Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show. I'm here with my good friend, film critic, Mark Boubian.
Thanks, Bob. And so there's some other references from Interstellar that I noticed, not from other films, but actually from some books from the golden age of science fiction. The Frederick Pohl is one of the great authors of that era, overshadowed by Asimov and Bradbury, of course, but he still had his great works. And a couple of those was a series known as the Gateway series. It goes by other names, but the first book was called Gateway, the second, Beyond the Blue Event Horizon. Now, the event horizon is a reference to a black hole. The event horizon is where light can no longer escape the gravity well of the black hole. That's where everything basically ends. No events occur past that point. So that movie, that book, Gateway, originally has some scenes very similar to what we see in Interstellar. Matthew McConaughey, they're orbiting the black hole. They need to escape its gravity well. And in order to do that, you need to eject some of your mass to be able to speed up. And this is one of the key plot points in the book Gateway. They're falling into a black hole, and to get out, they've got to eject some mass. And sure enough, that's what they do. And one of the people stays behind. Now, the difference between the book and the movie is Matthew McConaughey sacrifices himself and says, I'm dropping myself and my craft so that you, Anne Hathaway, can survive. In the book Gateway, it's actually the opposite. It's an accident. He knocks everybody else deeper into the black hole, and he escapes.
Now, one thing I didn't like about the movie, and it's the only thing, is it does look like they're setting us up for a sequel.
Yeah, and I heard that from someone else. And Nolan's never done a sequel except for the Batman movies, so I'm not sure if we need to be afraid of that or not.
Oh, that's good.
So,
because, again, sequels usually ruin the first
movie. Yes, and that this is a movie that could be ruined very badly
by a
sequel.
But it certainly looked. But on the other hand, there was a party that did want him to go back and rescue her. But
right.
And it's let us assume he's going to do it, and we don't have to see it.
So hopefully that's what will happen. And you know, it could be like Odyssey 2, where 10 years later somebody decides to make a sequel.
Well, he may feel that way, but I hope he owns it outright, because the studios that released it, they're already thinking of the dollar
sign.
Well, all they care about is whether people will come see the sequel.
He does own one of the production companies, so I'm not sure what his control is, but he's definitely got some controlling influence into what can happen.
No
with the movie
sequel,
and the
gentlemen. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right.
Leave well enough alone.
This is not broken. Okay, so the last reference I'll make is to E.E. Doc Smith. He is another Golden Age writer. There's one of the planets they land on is threatening because it's close to the black hole, and it's got these huge waves that are generated because of the gravity from the black hole. This comes from one of Doc Smith's the Lensman series. It's just a little brief reference, but it's similar because it's a planet in orbit around a neutron star, which is similar to a black hole, heavy gravity, high tides, super, super high, 1,000 feet high tides in this, and it plays some kind of plot point in that book. But so Nolan's references to these books was just, for me, a very exciting thing to see because I've grown up with science fiction. I've read science fiction as an adult. I continue to read it, and it looks to me like Nolan's done his own reading of science fiction, too. Looks like he's a fan himself. So.
Well, that's good. I remember one time they gave a special award, the Irving Thalberg Award, I think it's called, to Steven Spielberg. This was quite a few years ago at the Academy Awards.
Oh, okay.
And he made an interesting comment, which I thought was fascinating. He said the first generation of filmmakers grew up on books, and the next generation grew up on movies. And he said, I think we've seen a decline as a result of the fact that we didn't grow up. I mean, obviously they read books, but when movies had never been made before, books or possibly plays were all people had. I would just add to that this generation of filmmakers grew up on television, and boy, does that show with the remakes and the sequels. And to have a director like Nolan, all to say that
he's
if he was reading
books,
his science fiction as well as watching it, that probably accounted for some of the quality of this movie.
Right, and I'd have a hard time believing somebody today would be making a movie that is so really, really deeply based in that sort of golden age. Science is an imperative as part of science fiction, that he would not, I would be surprised if he didn't read that era or that wasn't involved in that era, because science is so imperative to this film.
And you enjoy reading science fiction a lot too, don't you?
Right. That's what I was talking about, Bob. Yeah, just a few
minutes ago. Yeah. Well, I heard you mentioning the science fiction right. books, but I didn't hear you yeah. mention that you've...
I've actually read, you like to read yes, a lot quite a few. There's yeah. a list of 100 best science fiction books. I've read about 98 of them.
So, wow.
Yeah. And the two that I haven't read, I don't have any desire to read, so I probably won't. But, you know, there's books on there like Clockwork Orange, for example.
Yeah, no, I've read Clockwork Orange. Yeah. 2000, so but, boy, I, don't, I didn't read there. All those hundreds that you did.
Nope. 2001's one of the books I won't read because I like
And
the
there
movie.
You go. Then that's the one I do read. So there we there go. Go. So we got it covered between the two of us.
Okay, so now one of the things I really love about Christopher Nolan's movies also, and one of the things I liked about Batman that pulled me in is, for me, movies aren't just about what the story is, you know, what's going on in the story or how the characters are developed. I like to see something deeper in the film, in the book. I like to be challenged morally, ethically, intelligently in some way or another. And what's so awesome about Christopher Nolan is his movies have been very strong in their moral or ethical or human challenges. The way he approaches humanity, the way he makes you look at your own humanity through the art form of film is just an amazing talent. All of the Batman movies had very strong moral themes. I mean, even The Dark Knight, one of the things I liked about it so much was that very fact. The Joker, the main antagonist, is somebody who has no morality. And the question is, how do you deal with somebody that is willing to do anything, that doesn't care about anything, even to the point that he doesn't care about his own life, which is illustrated in one scene in the film. So those kinds of questions, what do you do about that person? That's one moral question that you ask. But then you have in the film also the moral challenges that are direct with the people, where the Joker has a scene where he puts people on opposing ferries to escape Gotham City, and but he's got bombs on both of them, and he's given the trigger to the bomb.
And there's moral choices yeah, they have so, to make.
Right, exactly.
It involves sacrifice.
And this is a no-win situation. You blow up the other people. He says if you blow up the other ship, you survive and they die. And it's a no-win situation morally. And the people you watch the challenge and the conflict of these scenes is so intense because you connect so well with the idea of, do I blow someone else up to save my own life? So,
okay, we're talking about Christopher Nolan, some of his other movies, but more specifically Interstellar, the one that's a huge hit, critical and box office acclaim. We'll be right back. This is Bob Siegel for Skyline Church. Jesus said that his people should be the salt of the earth and the light of the world. Some churches take that mandate seriously, others, sadly, do not. I am happy to announce that there are many good, serious churches in San Diego, and Skyline is certainly one of them. Outreaches to the community and the world at large are carried on by our missionary family. Their ministries to the poor, the shut-ins, and the emotionally scarred. There are groups and classes for all ages, from children to middle school to high school, college, young adult, and senior citizen. Skyline is also on the cutting edge of today's social issues. We mobilize people and help them to be a better voice for the changing culture around us. Sunday services are at 9 o'clock and 11 o'clock every week. Skyline Church, located at 94 and Hamishaw. Welcome back to the Bob Siegel Show with film critic Mark Boubian.
Thanks, Bob. So in terms of morality, Christopher Nolan really hits the mark. Now, I want to mention one other film. An early film by him called Memento had one of the most powerful moments I can remember in a film. Now, this is a funny film where it actually plays out backwards because our main character has lost his ability to keep his short-term memory. So he only remembers 15 minutes worth of anything. And so he has tattoos on his body telling him what he's supposed to do. Now, he's out for vengeance because of a murder that occurred, and it all plays in with his inability to remember stuff. But there's a scene where he's working with somebody to try to find the killer, and he thinks he's very close. But finally, the person he's working with says, "You don't remember, but you already found the killer 10 years ago. And I'm just humoring you to keep you happy."
Well, I never saw that movie. Yeah. I remember seeing a preview. That's a fascinating twist in the movie.
Well, this isn't the twist.
Oh.
Our protagonist in the film, the man with the short-term memory loss, makes a conscious choice. He does not like what this guy is saying. So he's got a photograph of the guy, and he writes on the photograph. He crosses out what is written on the photograph and writes, "He's the one, kill him." So he consciously decides to murder this man, and he knows that he won't remember having written those words on that card.
He won't remember why he knew that he was the one to...
Right, and he won't remember why, exactly. So this is such a powerful moment in the movie, and he does murder this person, and again, the moral choice that he makes, the immoral choice in this case, is just such a powerful thing. And the whole movie comes together. To me, it came together in that moment. And I was just knocked out when that happened. It was just such a powerful idea and powerful element in the film. And I could go on and on about other films of his. Now, the funny thing about Interstellar is that there's not a lot of talk or a lot of conflict revolving around morality per se that I keyed in on, but there were two things that they really talked about quite a bit that were at odds. One was evolution, saving the human species. And this is the new language of movies, science fiction, that we've got to save our species. Our species needs to be saved. Now, nobody ever asks why our species needs to be saved when there's some threat to it, but that's just what they say. Now, in the past,
if you are the species, that's why.
Right, you care, but
yeah, but in terms of getting more philosophical and saying,
yes,
what is
it
about it mankind that it matters?
Right. Now, this what's interesting about this movie is it didn't really attack that idea so much as engage it from a different angle, where it didn't ask why are we worth saving, what is worth saving about us, but it challenged the idea of the atheistic evolution. I kind of have a way of delineating between two ways
right.
of evolution.
Theistic One is evolution theistic and versus atheistic evolution.
And not theistic, but a Christian view that if evolution occurred, then that's how God created man, and Adam was just one of the evolved.
Evolution
whatever.
Would just be the process
right.
God used.
And I don't care. I don't know the science. I'm never going to claim to. Hate biology. So
not the hill
for
to
me,
die
it's
for.
A wash. Yeah. But the point for me, though, is whether or not you're going to engage the idea of evolution as a meaning for life or meaning for existence. And that's what evolution is used as now. And I don't agree with that. But I'm willing to engage in a conversation about that and talk about it. And that's why one of the strengths of movies like this is it gives you the chance to. And in the movie, there's this sense that evolution, yeah, okay, we all accept that. That's it. That's the way it works. We've got to save our species because we evolved and so on, so and so on. But there's other things that are inexplicable. And that other thing that they key in on is love.
Yeah, because they were pitting saving the species as opposed to, I forget the species, I just want to save this person because this is the person I love, or
right.
these people, my family.
Right, exactly. And that's one aspect of it where there's a fight scene that occurs with Matthew McConaughey and another actor who doesn't want to be named in the film. And I think it's good that he doesn't, because there's a scene where if you knew who he was, it would detract from the scene.
Using unknowns in movies can be very effective.
Yeah, but this
you think
is a known,
more as
but,
the character,
yeah.
right? But what they made him an
oh,
unknown.
Oh, I see. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So, but his character is named Man, M-A-N-N, Man. And he is
homage to Man Theaters. Since he's giving a homage to everything else, he might as well do that.
I actually think it was a little more symbolic than that, to be honest, Bob. That's kind of where I'm headed. And he has this fight where he's trying to kill Matthew McConaughey's character and comes very close to succeeding. And during the fight, the whole conversation is about evolution, how we deserve to survive as a species. We've got to save humanity. And to save humanity, I have to murder you. I have to do something evil. I have to do something terrible. Now, he never says that, but that's what's going on while he's talking about evolution. And earlier in the film, there's a very mild discussion about evolution amongst the characters where Anne Hathaway's character brings up the idea that, you know, nature is evil. Nature can be evil, that it kills people, you know, and that's what's going on the planet Earth. Nature has gone awry and is basically murdering people, so to speak. And Matthew McConaughey disagrees. He says, no, nature is not evil. It's formidable. It's dangerous. Yes, it can kill us, but it doesn't have evil. And the conversation goes on, and then he finally says, so are you saying, you're basically saying that whatever is evil, we bring with us, which is a very powerful statement. So the evil that we as human beings see, that's in our hearts. It's not out there in nature.
Very similar theme to Forbidden Planet, even though that was a completely different story.
Right, and a very absolutely
monster
great
at the end
movie.
Ended up just being them, their projections of evil.
Yes, exactly. And so here, this film, and then we see the person that is actually doing evil is the one arguing for the preservation of the species. And in a sense, it does kind of raise that question.
It was an end justifies the means, and yet it was like a vicious circle.
Yeah.
Why should we preserve ourselves? Well, because we should.
Right, exactly. There's no answer to that question.
And that was supposedly a moral thing to preserve ourselves, and yet he sacrificed all morality to do that.
Exactly. And so I felt that was a really good moment in the film. It was a little bit of, it went on a little too long, and it was, interestingly, the fight scene didn't quite fit the movie in terms of its tone, but it's still there. It was, and it did convey some sense of this concept of evolution. And I really, really enjoyed the discussion of love, because that, you know, we talk about morality, we talk about, and as Christians, we will talk about love. But what was awesome about this is that there were some things said about love that I had never really thought about, where the discussion becomes not necessarily about where love comes from, but how we engage in love.
Okay, we'll talk more about this film and how we engage in love when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. BobSiegel.net.
Talking about the film Interstellar, it's always good to have film critic Mark Boobian with us.
And it's always a joy to be here, Bob, and I mean that. So Here we are out in space, deep space, through wormholes and black holes, planets with big waves, and time that's distorted. And one of the key elements in the film is this sense of what is love? What drives us as human beings? Why does this drive us as human beings, I should say? And how it's pitted against evolution. Not necessarily up, it's not pitted against evolution in your face, but to me there's two separate kind of discussions going on in the film that are sort of juxtaposed or given at opposing times that don't correlate at all. So Anne Hathaway has some beautiful lines about love. She says to Matthew McConaughey when he's discussing when they're discussing nature being evil or not, and the idea of when a lion eats a deer, is that evil? Well, no, it's not. That's just the way the lion is. Well, then why wouldn't Matthew McConaughey being killed on this planet be different? And the answer, one of the answers the film may be giving, the implication is that love would be one of those driving factors. Morality, of course, being the overall, that, you know, just like we were talking about before with other Nolan movies, morality being such an important part. But Anne Hathaway says to Matthew McConaughey, in terms of love, she says, you know, love is inexplicable. It's something that we don't understand. And she's saying it as though we never will. There's no equation for love. There's no understanding of love. It's completely a mystery to us as human beings, even though it is the core, one of the core parts of our being. She says, look, we love people who are far away. We still love them, even though they're gone and maybe never be a part of our lives again.
And if it was just evolution and survivalist instinct,
why would we care?
Why would we care? Exactly. What does it have to do with our survival?
She goes further, though. We love people that are dead. We don't stop loving them because they died. And I mean, now to
or what
I
even
bring
makes
up
you,
great examples
or even
of that.
With romance, what makes you fall in love?
Right.
You can't.
Exactly.
We don't exactly understand what that is, and yet we
right.
Just,
and we don't choose to fall in love. That's not a choice we get to make. I've never heard of anybody saying I chose to fall in love with her. I mean, I met her and I fell in love with her, and I maybe chose to go on a date with her and spend time, but I didn't choose to fall in love with her. I fell in love with
her. If I can quote from a musical for just a moment. In Camelot,
right, Bob,
Merlin's, you'll like this line though, even though it's in a musical. They didn't sing it. They said
spoke it.
Merlin says to King Arthur, love is kind of a Sabbath day so that thinking can rest.
That's an interesting quote. And boy, talk about being opposed to everything we in this generation would be opposed to. That idea, that goes against the grain. Science is it. But he's right.
We've made a god out of science. By denying God, people have made a god out of science itself.
Right. And I have a science degree. I love science.
It's a tool.
Beautiful.
It's a tool, but not to replace God.
Right, exactly. And the difference is there's physics and there's metaphysics. There's physics are how do things work. Metaphysics is why do things work. Why is there order in the universe? Physics
doesn't
answer that.
You have to have humility to explore metaphysics. Einstein said anybody who studies this universe becomes convinced that there's a manifest spirit at work, one to whom we should all be humble. And that was Einstein.
Right.
Atheists
right.
like to say he was an atheist. He wasn't. He
right.
wasn't a Christian, but he certainly believed in some kind
Something.
Of spiritual
okay.
deity.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I don't know the beliefs of the people that have written this movie and produced it. I don't know what Christopher Nolan believes, but...
But like you always say, when people are made in the image of God, that's going to come through, even if they're not conscious of it.
And if you're honest about human beings, you're going to run into the things that Christianity teaches
right.
us about ourselves.
If we come from God and we're honest about human beings, then we're, to some degree, we're being honest about God.
Right, exactly. And what's cool about the movie, too, is love becomes a connecting factor that sort of transcends time and space as well, even though it's kind of subtly done. And a really good example of love in the film that we see that is tested to its greatest extent is Matthew McConaughey has to leave his daughter behind, who obviously their relationship is extremely close. It's his, you know, it's his wife had died, and I mean, it's clear that his daughter is the love of his life, truly and purely. And the same goes for the daughter to the father. They are just, it's like, you know, the that stereotypical, you're my favorite kid. And that's how it's depicted in the movie. And he leaves her behind to go on this mission, promising to come back. But, you know, you really get the sense he's not going to come back, especially when we start to talk about the time distortions that occur near deep gravity wells and black holes. It becomes clear at some point he's, hey, this guy is not coming back. He didn't tell his daughter the truth. And she's so angry with him that she grows up. We see her grow up in the film because time on Earth passes much quicker.
Which was very interesting.
Yeah, and that's how it works.
I'm
that's
such
the real
a sucker
physics.
For time travel stories. Yes, yeah. And that was. It was because they have established that there's such a thing as going into the future, or hypothetically.
Right.
If we could go beyond the speed of light, going into the past is what they're still arguing about.
I actually read that even the Apollo astronauts and jet pilots can... The relativity of motion as well as the relativity of gravity both have effects, and they've been measured by in both of those cases. So
well,
I
even
think
on a regular airline, they've measured it with atomic clocks.
They go
like a millisecond
right.
into the future, but we'll never notice it.
Right, because it's such a tiny
right.
amount. But here, at one point in the movie, they are blasting down to this planet as fast as they can because they know that every hour spent on the planet is 7 years in orbit.
Yeah.
And they get stuck.
That was just such a fascinating thing to watch and see unfold.
It was so great. That was awesome. I loved it. I so much loved those time distortion elements to the film. But again, now getting back to the love aspect, even though this time is passing at different rates and they're separated as much as two human beings possibly can, the daughter harbors so much resentment and anger towards her father. It's clear, even as an adult, that she is just terrorized by being left behind. Yet, her love for him never, ever fades. And that Jessica Chastain is the adult version of the daughter. And her ability to carry that, both the ability to convey her disdain, her anger, that deep-seated just loss of her father, yet still carry love for him and convey both of those at the same time in this film is just an amazing thing. And she's not in the movie a ton, but the scenes that she does are just so great. So and I love her as an actress. She's just absolutely wonderful, and she really nailed it in this movie. And Matthew McConaughey being kind of that regular guy, you know, you never lose the sense that he's got this great love for his daughter too. And so these are the things that kind of bind them together and bring them together, and ultimately that is what saves humanity, the love of a father and daughter. And it's not evolution, it's not, I mean, it's physics to a large extent as well, but
that was just
it's fantasy
the mechanism
physics
which
point.
Allowed it to happen. His motive and determination is what
exactly was,
and not for that it wouldn't have happened.
Right, and the physics at the point of saving humanity becomes fantasy because we don't know what it occurs in the black hole, and we don't know what's going to happen at all when you go into a black hole. I mean, there's mathematics for it, but we just don't.
But this just made it such a perfect movie because visually it's an experience. It's something you'll want to go see. I would go see this again because it's like going on a ride again. It's just visually. Some movies I like, but I would have no reason to see again. But then there's this message to it, and it makes us think. And so it's as entertaining as it is thought-provoking.
Right. And that's what great art is all about. And for me, this is why I, you know, it's Batman. Something I absolutely could not stand.
For a guy in tights, and look what Christopher Nolan was able to do to
yes,
you.
Yes, exactly. And so in this movie, he does something very similar.
Okay.
But
you want to go out and see it, Interstellar. Mark, it's always good having you.
Thank you, Bob.
You on again soon. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.